This episode of The Girlfriend Bracket is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. With free shipping on orders of $100 or more, a 25% buy list bonus, and their ever-popular customer rewards program, CoolStuffInc is the store for all of your Magic the Gathering needs.
Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well. Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well. Live fast, die young, bad girls do it well.
Everybody, this is episode number 34 of The Girlfriend Bracket. My name is Erin.
I'm Hallie.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Chris.
And we are here on this Veterans Day. So if you happen to be somebody who has served in the armed forces or is serving right now, we certainly appreciate you and all that you do, and especially for listening to our show. Woman of Excellence this week is a woman I had the pleasure of meeting recently named Barbara McCann from Washington. And Hallie, you actually know Barbara, and you got to interview her while you two were in Seattle. So why don't you tell everybody why she is our Woman of Excellence this week?
Sure. So Barbara has not actually been playing Magic for very long. She started about a year ago when her daughter taught her how to play. And she got really into Magic. She's one of those people where whenever she finds something that she likes, she really latches onto it and puts her all into it. And when she started playing Magic and getting into it, she started taking it very seriously. And, you know, she would come to FNM, she would come to Lady Planeswalker Society, and she would always, you know, ask me for help because she realized that I was one of the more competitive players, and she was always just looking to improve, you know, whether she was winning or losing, always looking for things she can do better. And when it was announced that there was going to be a Legacy Grand Prix in the greater Seattle area, she just jumped at the chance to go. It was her first Grand Prix. She spent about 3 or 4 months practicing, you know, 3 or 4 times a week for this Grand Prix. Even though she had no prior experience playing Legacy and very little experience playing Magic. And she was just sort of an inspiration to a lot of women in the community. Some other women from Lady Planeswalker Society started, you know, teaming up with her, testing with her. You know, she helped them learn their decks for the tournament while she was learning Merfolk. And she was just really inspirational to watch, and she went to the GP. She finished 5-4, which is not too shabby for your first GP, especially in a format like Legacy, which is really unforgiving. And I just wanted to, you know, recognize her for all her hard work and effort. You know, it certainly paid off.
That's fantastic.
Did her daughter come too?
She came on Sunday to look around the venue, and I think she may have done a side event. I don't know. Her daughter is 14, and she's sort of at an age where, you know, kids go through phases where they'll like something for 6 months, and then they'll move on to the next thing. And it seems like that's the case for her. But Barbara seems like she's in it for the long haul.
Nice.
I remember reading the interview that you did with her, Hallie, and at the end of it, she said that she was nearing retirement and that she couldn't wait to have all that free time to devote to the game. So when she retires, we may very well see her on the Pro Tour.
Absolutely.
I would love that. So speaking of Seattle, Hallie, you were there. Like you said, this was a Legacy GP. The top eight included 2 copies of Shardless Sultai, which is basically like a bug, almost like a bug version of Jund that you see in Legacy that revolves around a card called Shardless Agent, which is sort of like the bug Bloodbraid Elf, I guess you could say.
That cascade, though.
Yeah. 1 copy of Lands, 1 copy of Grixis Delver, 1 copy of Jeskai Miracles, 1 copy of Reanimator, and 1 copy of a deck called Alorin. And I want to talk about Alorin for a little bit, because it's pretty rare. It's something that the chat was very excited to see, and I just wanted to go over this combo because I think it's so fantastic. So Alorin revolves around an enchantment called Alorin that costs 2 and 2 green, and Alorin says that when any player may play creature cards with a converted mana cost of 3 or less without paying their mana costs, and you can play those cards as if they had flash. So you want to get Alorin on the board. And then there's a card called Imperial Recruiter, which is surprisingly $300. It looks harmless enough. It looks like a simple portal card, but no, it costs an arm and a leg. And you use Imperial Recruiter to go looking for your combo pieces, which are Parasitic Strix and Cavern Harpy. Parasitic Strix is 2 and a blue, and when it enters the battlefield, when it comes into play, if you control a black permanent, a target player loses 2 life and you gain 2 life. And then with Cavern Harpy, you're able to use one of those 2 life to activate the Cavern Harpy, and then just establish this loop of returning the Strix, returning the Harpy, because of Allura, and you're not paying for their mana cost, and eventually you drain your opponent to death. Mm-hmm. Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
I also want to add that the young man who made top 8 with Reanimator, Chase Hansen, that is my buddy Clashed.
I know him too.
You know Chase?
Yeah. So he and Martin Goldman Curse, the guy who was playing Allurin, they're both Seattle locals.
Mm-hmm.
And Chase has been playing Reanimator for a very long time. I don't know him very well, but on one of the few occasions that I've been able to make it out to Card Kingdom to play Legacy on Monday nights, I did have the pleasure of playing against him. Or I don't know if you would say pleasure. He did play turn 2 Grizzlebrands in both games, but... But yeah, he's been playing Reanimator for a long time and knows the deck really well, so I'm not surprised that he made top 8.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's my buddy from Magic Online. Like, I've talked about him on the show. He's the Reanimator player that I like to kiki with every once in a while, and every time we do get paired together, he beats me. And I saw him on Moto the other day, and I was like, Clash, how's it going? And he goes, oh, I top 4 the GP.
So it's going fine. I guess.
Yeah. And I'm like, what? And so I go to look at the events coverage page and I'm like, you're Chase Hansen? Like, I've been friends with you this whole time and I had no idea. And he's like, yeah, I don't really get to events much. So when I go, I like to make it a good showing. And I was like, I can't believe I know you. And like, for a solid 2 minutes, I was just saying, oh my God. And oh my God. And just for a good 2 minutes. And I'm like, okay, this isn't even me. Like, I should calm the hell down. And but he's a really nice guy and is very happy to see that he did that well.
Nice.
Hallie, what was your experience like? You got to do text coverage.
I did. So I was volunteering on the text coverage team. I basically was there to help with the sort of human interest stories. So as you mentioned earlier, I interviewed my friend Barbara because I thought that, you know, she definitely was unique. You know, she represents a shifting demographic. More moms are playing Magic. I've definitely seen that as I've been, you know, working at conventions like PAX Prime and Emerald City Comic Con. I have more and more women come to me and ask me to teach them to play Magic. So I thought that sharing her story would be great. And I was also given the opportunity to interview a pro player because the text coverage team wanted sort of like a short piece on, you know, a pro player who was at the event and, you know, what they chose and why. And so I got to interview Aaron's favorite Magic pro, Reed Duke.
Shut up.
Yeah. It was tough. They gave me the choice, essentially, of who I wanted to interview. And at that point, I was basically looking for, you know, someone who was doing well in the event and someone who I thought I would have a lot to say to, and at that point, Reed was 6-0, and I had read a number of articles that he's written about Legacy, including one that he wrote about 18 months ago when he was sort of at a crossroads where he was looking to improve his Legacy play after just stints of playing a lot of sort of niche decks just over and over again. And, you know, I thought it was a really great article, and I wanted to kind of, like, follow up with him. So I ended up talking to him for about 5 minutes. He was a really nice guy. He's just as, you know, kind as everyone makes him out to be. And, yeah, it was a really great experience.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I saw the article, and I was like, I was like, Hallie, you got to interview Bay. I was like, so I was very excited about that. So walk me through this. So now, did you have to pitch them your ideas, or did you say that they gave you the topics and then you had to flesh them out?
The latter. They gave me some rough guidelines and I had to come up with the specifics.
Okay. Now, I would imagine that the turnaround time on these articles is quite small. So did somebody go over them or tell you to maybe redo them or do it a little differently? Like, how did that work?
I don't know. My editor was pretty happy with the work that I did. I showed up at around noon on Saturday, spent about 7 hours doing a combination of writing and interviewing. I had spoken to Barbara the previous day, so that cut down the time a little bit. But essentially from 12 until 7, I was just hanging out on the stage with, you know, Stibbs and Mike Rosenberg and just banging out articles.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is this something that you would do again?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Now, I know we kind of talked about the difference between, like, the human interest pieces and, like, the technical play where you're describing plays. Is that something you think you might want to move into, or were you happy with the sphere that you were in?
I was very happy doing the human interest pieces. It was a lot of fun to write, and I got to put a lot of my personality into it. But I'm sure that doing more play-by-play analysis would provide its own unique challenges, and I think I would enjoy writing those as well.
I think you would be great at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chris, you also saw some event play this past weekend. You were at a premiere 5K?
Yes.
Okay, and tell us about that.
I decided to go play standard. I've been working on this Artificer aggro deck, which is not really my wheelhouse, just to kind of try something different. So I have PN, Kieran, Nalar in there. I have four of those. I have three Whirler Rogues and four Thopter Engineers, so most of the deck is based around that. And I also have four Hangarback Walkers and four Chief of the Foundry. So basically, make a bunch of Thopters, throw Thopters at people, make Hangarback Walker big, those kind of shenanigans, put Ghost Fireblade on. And it's been a lot of fun. And I have been tweaking the deck. I've been working on it downtime at work type of thing. I've been playtesting with people. And I actually really like the deck. And it's funny because at FNM last week, people are like looking over my shoulder, what you doing with that? What's all this about? And I'm just like, I don't know. I just wanted to have fun. So that was the deck that I decided to bring to the 5K. I haven't played standard much, so I figured it was best to do FNM the night before just to kind of see what people were playing. I had kind of a rough road. I played Abzan the first round, and I lost pretty abysmally to them. Admittedly, the first game, I didn't get too many lands, which is kind of awful, but it was probably just a bad matchup for me all around regardless. The second round, I played Green-Black Aristocrats. The deck is fucking crazy. Like, blew my mind. And I'm playing against this, like, I don't know, like, 12-year-old kid who's playing this Green-Black Aristocrats deck, and he was just like, I don't know, he was just hilarious. I loved him. But Green-Black seems to be a good build for that Aristocrats deck. I know a lot of people are doing the Blue-Black build, but Green-Black seems to be the way to go. So that was kind of difficult for me, especially when you have, what, a 14-14 Nantuko Husk swinging at you with Rogue's Passage? What the fuck? Okay. All right. I guess. So that was kind of sad. My friend that I went with to the tournament, he started off pretty well. He was like 2-0 or 3-0 before he finally started losing some matches. And he had brought like a green-red landfall deck with him or something. I can't remember. And then third round, I played Jeskai Black, which is my first experience playing Jeskai Black. I still don't care for it. It doesn't seem like it would be a fun deck for me to play. I don't care if it has Jace and this and that. It just, the feel, something about it feels wrong to me. I don't know what it is. But I lost pretty badly to Jeskai Black. After I was like, okay, be like, I guess I'm just done. Then I played this guy who was doing a red-green deck with creatures that he was, like, adding counters to. So it was kind of like a Hardened Scales variation, but it wasn't, like, the typical deck list. And he was saying that he mostly does a lot of homebrews and everything, and that he just kind of plays what he likes to play. I'm like, me too, man. So we kind of had, like, a moment there, and his deck was pretty sweet. And then the fifth round, which was the last round I played, I had to play Green-Black Aristocrats again, and I had to play against my friend Sage, that was also like 0-4, so that was really sad. But same thing, very, very strong deck. I mean, if I was going to pick another deck to play, it would probably be the Aristocrats deck. It looks pretty fun. I'm still glad I went to kind of see what was going on in Standard. I'd like to, like I said, have a deck just kind of ready to play if I want to do standard events, but I think my focus is still going to be on modern and turning into Legacy slowly. But I believe in my Thopters deck, so I'm just going to keep on rocking it out.
Do you think that you're going to take that to Oakland?
It depends. It depends on what's going on, I guess, magical-wise by that point. But I think it's fun. Like, if anything, it would just be fun just to have to play for the GP, because it's a fun deck to play. Like, if at this point I was like, this deck is stupid and I don't even like piloting it, then I would just give up on it. But I still believe in it. I just want to make some tweaks. And I was happy that somebody liked it on Deckstats. So if it was any of our listeners, thank you. So, yeah, it's sweet. I like it. But I found it interesting. People are like, oh, you're still trying to make that deck be a thing? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, this whole thing within Soul. I'm like, I wasn't even playing really standard then. And I really know nothing about that deck very much. So, nope, it's not the same deck. It's different. You know, people, I think they like to assume that you're trying to force something that was popular, even though it's not popular anymore, but it's like, it's not the same deck. It's completely different. I mean, even in my sideboard is Disdainful Stroke. I have two Disperse so that you can get your Pia and Kieran back, two Fiery Impulse, two Rending Volley, one Boiling Earth, four Roast, and I have two Aligned Hedron Network in there just for the Eldrazi craziness that's running around. Yeah.
And Soul Artifact isn't even standard legal anymore.
Yeah, but people still, they just bring it up because when it was a thing, they're like, oh, Hangerback Walker, Blue-Red Artifacts, and then the, you know, rotation happened, and then all that stuff rotated out. So I think people are just thinking that I'm, like, trying to keep that dream alive. It's like, no, I just wanted to make a deck with Artificers.
Like, but even if you were, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, I'm not sure how that's supposed to be insulting to you. Like, so even if you were, like, Godspeed, you know?
No, I know. It was just weird because I'm like, I didn't know anything about that deck. But it felt like people were trying to make it weird. I don't know. I was like, I just wanted to do a deck with Artificers. I just wanted to do my thing.
You just came to play Artifacts. That's all.
So it was fun.
Yeah. So thanks to Hallie, I decided to play standard and build a standard deck. Hallie gave me a little kick in the pants that I needed. I was being kind of angsty about the standard, and she was like, you know what, girl? She's like, if you're going to play standard, she's like, you need to look at it this way. You need to go into it for this reason. And I was like, Hallie, you are absolutely right. So I decided to play Eldrazi Ramp. I started off with a build written about by Josh McLean from Channel Fireball. He wrote about a green-white build, and it didn't really feel good. It felt like there were some gaps in it, and so somebody recommended Gabby Spartz because she's been playing in the Super Standard League with a green-red build. She's now 3-0 in the league. She's completely undefeated, and I watched all of her matches, and seeing how well she did and the tools that she had at her disposal made me want to play her build. So I built Red-Green Eldrazi, and I've been playing with it and having a lot of fun. The deck is super broken, and it's kind of my style where, like, I'm ignoring you for, like, 6 turns, and then when I'm ready to do something, you'll know it.
Yeah, I was on Twitter, and Erin likes to post screenshots of her matches on Magic Online, and so I looked at the screenshot she posted, and I saw an Ulamog in her graveyard, and I was like, oh god, what just happened here? And I was like, Erin, why is there an Ulamog in your graveyard? And she was like, because I chained them.
But that's the whole point of Gabby's build, is that, you know, you want to play a Hangerback Walker for 4 and then sacrifice Sanctum of Ugin and go looking for an Ulamog, or cast an Ulamog, sacrifice for another Ulamog. And because those are cast triggers, that exile effect is a cast trigger, you can just cast it. Oh, too bad, I've got to sacrifice it, but you're still out 2 more permanents. Mm-hmm. And there were plenty of times I was doing that. And I really like the deck. I have it all built. I'm just now assembling it on paper. Which is more expensive than online. I've had to go back to Puka Trade and dump some of my rares to pay for it. But I should have it built by the time I get to Oakland, and I'll be playing a bit more online. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you all about before we move on to other topics is people were pointing to the success of GP Seattle as if to say that this was proof that Legacy isn't dying. Because before Seattle, there was a lot of talk of where Legacy was going, with SCG seeming to cut back on how much Legacy they were supporting. Do you think that's accurate? Like, do you think we can look at Seattle and say this is proof that Legacy is fine, or that it's going to be okay?
I think Legacy will stick around for a very long time. Like, I just find it funny that the Magic community one week is like, it's dying, and then this week they're like, it's proof that it's not dying. And it's just, like, back and forth all the time. But I think Legacy will be fine. Like, even with less events or other people picking up the slack on Legacy events, I think that, you know, the people that have the cards will stick around for a long time, because it seems like everybody that plays Legacy is, like, a diehard Legacy fan, so, you know, mm-hmm. they'll always be around.
Yeah, I can attest that that's absolutely true. The Seattle Legacy community is great. I was just looking through the standings and seeing, like, just how many of our local Legacy players did well, which I think is really cool. But, yeah, I think, like Katie said, the people who like Legacy really like it. They're total diehards. There are people who came from across the country and from around the world to play in this event. Tomoharu Saito showed up to play in this event all the way from Japan. I mean, people who are into this format are really into it, so mm-hmm. I don't think it's going anywhere.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I've been listening to the Leaving a Legacy podcast lately, and they were talking about that on their last show, and they were saying that with SCG kind of moving out of some things, that it would give other people a chance to kind of pick some things up, and I'm hoping that that happens, because it would be nice to actually have things for us to do in the Midwest, because I feel like they think about the East Coast and the West Coast a lot, but they forget about us in the middle of nowhere. So it's like, I would like to play Legacy, but I don't want to invest in a deck that costs a boatload if I have no reason to play it. So they mentioned some place in Michigan was possibly going to be picking it up. So if so, please come here. We want you.
Speaking of Legacy, I saw that Card Kingdom is going to be hosting a really unique event called Rags to Riches.
Mm-hmm.
It is a pauper tournament because, you know, part of the problem with being able to, you know, with getting the mean or with getting the cards to play Legacy is that a lot of times you have to play Legacy or play Modern to be able to win those staples, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's a pauper tournament, which doesn't cost very much to invest in. And if you win the pauper tournament, you have a chance of winning, like, some fetch lands, some snapcasters and things like that. I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah, I saw it and I immediately sent a message to our tournament organizer and was like, thank you so much for doing this. Like, I think this is absolutely what the community needs. I should add that I'm making a point of not going to this tournament because I want, you know, they only have so many slots, and I want to make sure that the people who attend it are the people who actually need those staples. I mean, I have my Scalding Tarns, I have my Snapcasters. If someone else needs them, let them get the slot. And my biggest fear with a tournament like this is that a lot of grinders are going to come in and try to spike it. You know, people, not the people who this tournament was not intended for, but I'm hoping that a lot of newer players or players who don't have access to those high-end cards do get to play and do end up doing well.
Yeah, you brought up a really good point. I would hate to see that happen. Mm-hmm. They're just so innovative with their events. You know, we saw the No Modern Ban List event, mm-hmm. and now we saw the Rags to Riches, and I just love seeing what kind of things they come up with and how they turn out. I think other stores could learn a lot from that.
Mm-hmm. Modern No Ban List has become a recurring event now.
Yes.
They've had several of them, and there's going to be one coming up in December that I'm thinking about playing in.
Oh, God, that sounds like fun. Like, I would just go with Hypergenesis and have a gay old time. And
whee!
Speaking of events, there was a recent announcement about combining events. Now, Katie, can you kind of break this down for me? Because I'm still not really clear as to what it meant.
So I think previously, if I understood it correctly, tournament organizers could take an event like an SCG IQ is the most popular one I've seen, and put it with a pre-TQ. And I think they were being run as one tournament, and I think Wizards was okay with that. And now they've changed it to where apparently some of the prize breakdowns and what the tournament actually was unclear, and so they've made it so you just can't combine a Wizards tournament, like a PPTQ, with any other kind of tournament. Like, it has to just be a PPTQ.
Okay. And do you all feel that this is a good change? Like, I'm not really sure what the problem was.
I've been to tournaments that were not run very well. that have been combined. I once played in a Grand Prix trial that was also billed as an SCGIQ, and there were supposed to be things given to us because it was an SCGIQ that were not actually given to us because there was some sort of miscommunication. I don't know, but I think it can get kind of confusing when you have all these different events that have different structures and different prizes attached to them and different things to give the players, and you try to throw them all together and make them one event. I just don't think it turns out very well most of the time.
Yeah, to me it sounds like, you know, the stores are trying to get people to come to events that that wouldn't fire by themselves. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to, you know, repackage them and maybe make them more attractive. And I, you know, people have said that GPTs are just not that popular anymore and that they should kind of be discontinued. And I think if you have to do all of that to get people to come, maybe those events just aren't viable anymore and that you should focus on just the, you know, the IQs and things of that nature that you know are going to bring people in.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
There was a post on Channel Fireball that got a lot of attention recently, and then specifically, Katie, I'm dying to hear what you think about this. It was written by Paulo, Tor Dama de Rosa, and the article was all about slow play, which has been a hotly debated topic for a while now. And his article covered four important points. Well, there were, I think, one or two more, but I just want to focus on these four. First off, Paulo talks about removing the stigma around slow play. You know, if somebody says that you're playing slow and that you need to pick up the pace, it doesn't mean you're cheating. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've done anything wrong per se. The second thing he brought up is that slow play warnings are extremely inconsistent. He posted some video coverage clips of him and other people playing and showing how, you know, this person was playing for so long and didn't get a slow play warning, but he did, and he didn't understand why that was. The third point was that judges do not enforce slow play early on, but overcompensate later. And the other important point that I found, at least, was judges telling a player to play faster in the middle of a play will oftentimes cause the opposite effect to happen. Katie, as a judge, what do you think about all of this? Like, is this true?
I agreed with mostly everything he said. I think that every time attention is drawn to slow play, it's a good thing. I think what he said about the slow play warnings, about them being inconsistent, is so true. Like, I don't know. You can take one judge who's pretty good at giving slow play warnings, and, like, on another day, maybe they just, you know, aren't on top of it. Or, you know, some people who... I've seen a couple people who have rushed slow play warnings. Like, the person has just, like, drawn their card, and they've thought for, like, 10 seconds, and then they're like, all right, you need to play faster. And the person's like, what? Okay, I just drew my card. And so I've definitely seen it be inconsistent. And I think it's really hard, you know, as a judge, even with a lot of experience, being, like, interrupting a game just to tell somebody to play faster. It's like, I don't know. When somebody's really focused, like, in a very competitive scene, it's hard to just interrupt that focus. Like, you don't know if they're about to make that play. He talks about waiting for them to make the play before telling them they were slow. And sometimes it's like, well, I think they're going to make it. And then, like, 25 seconds later, you're like, okay, I still haven't made it, but maybe now's the time. And so you can kind of get in a, you know, negative loop like that. But I really liked everything he had to say. I don't necessarily agree that... So if a person is taking, like, a minute and they're thinking about this really complicated attack, and we do the fix that Paulo says, where you tell them they were slow afterwards. So they declare they're attackers. Do you tell them right then, before the other person has been before they've declared blockers, and you're like, excuse me, you were too slow right there. Like, to me, that just seems really awkward. And I do see what he's saying, where interrupting them, it does, you know, it sets people back. And they're like, oh, and then their train of thought's all gone, and sometimes that's, you know, disruptive, but I feel like it's kind of even weirder to tell them afterwards, like, you should have played that faster. Like, I guess I don't see a really great way for that to go, but I do believe in giving slow play warnings at the beginning of a round. I think that some people set the tone for how fast they're going to play within the first, you know, 5 minutes of match time. And I know I see Brooke do it a lot just as a player. You know, he always plays, like, the dirtiest control decks. So, especially, he played, like, even Phlox, you know, blue-white control that doesn't have a win condition, where they just, like, Elixir of Immortality you to death. And he was playing that, and it was, like, turn two of a game, and I was watching his match, and he was like, could you just play a little bit faster? Like, we're gonna need to get through this match. And the person's like, we have 48 minutes left. And he's like, I know, but it takes me a long time to play my deck, so. And I mean, all of his plays were super fast, but just the nature of that deck is, you know, grindy. So, I do believe that, you know, they should be given throughout the whole round, but I mean, even, I think all judges are kind of guilty of it, that towards the end, everybody's like, well, we need to do end of round, we need to get this show on the road, and then everybody's like, okay, play faster. And I don't think that harbors a very good, you know, sense from the players when they're being rushed, when they already feel the time pressure, and then a judge is looming over them, and then they're telling them to play faster, and then they're all stressed out, you know? I don't think that's the best way to approach it. So I think everybody needs to be a little more diligent. Mm-hmm.
Hallie, how do you feel about this as a player? Like, how would you prefer, like, if you were slow playing, you know, how would you prefer the judge to approach you about that?
Oh, God. That's never happened to me, so I'm actually not sure. I'm usually the one who's telling my opponents to play faster. I actually don't know. I'm not sure. I have to kind of put myself in that mindset and think, like, if I'm in the middle of something, do I want to be interrupted? I mean, I'm someone with a one-track mind, so I imagine that would really set me off. Like, I'm really bad at multitasking. I'm really bad at kind of, like, thinking about, you know, if I get off track, it's really hard for me to right myself again. So I imagine that would be really frustrating for me. But I am also the person who will, you know, tell my opponent to play faster. Like, if our game one takes a while, as we're shuffling up for game two, I'll try to, as politely as I can, say to my opponent, hey, that first game took a little while. Would you mind, like, trying to pick up the pace for game two or something like that? And I also agree that it's not always enforced evenly. I know slow play is really subjective, and it's not like judges have the ability to just sit there with stopwatches and actually see how long people are taking, but I've been in situations, specifically at, like, team-limited events, where one of my teammates got a slow play warning when her opponent was taking significantly longer than she was, and I wish there were a better fix for it.
Mm-hmm. So, Katie, how do you feel that we combat this? Like, is this something that you can teach judges? Like, I know you guys have your conferences and things like that. You know, how do you propose we make this better?
I think it's something that is brought up a lot. Like, I know Riki Hayashi is a very big advocate for slow play warnings, not when they're unnecessary, but just being diligent about it. And just in the past, like, 6 months or so, I've tried to, when I'm running a pre-TQ and I have a new L1 with me or something, being like, okay, we want this tournament to run smoothly, we want it to run fast, just be on the lookout. Doesn't necessarily mean you need to give them a warning, but just be like, hey, I need you to make a play. And then, you know, if it goes past that and they need something else, then a warning might be necessary. But I think the stigma part is really important, like, for players to understand that when a judge is talking to you and they tell you to play faster, it's not like you're bad at the game and I need you to fix it. Or it's not like we're watching you for stalling right now because we think you're cheating. It's just you need to play faster. Like, that's all it is. So I think that's important. And I think it is important in training new judges, because I know a lot of upper level judges are not very diligent about it. And I think it seems to be the more competitive judges are usually a little better, because they understand that if they were the player, they would want the person playing faster. And so I think it's just like a big raising awareness issue.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you think about putting some of the responsibility on players. Like, let's say you're a fan of those, you know, what I like to call bore you to tears control decks, where you've got like your one Aetherling, your one Elixir, and that's how you plan on winning the game. Do you think that it's something the players can do, where if you know that you're playing that deck really, really slowly, or that you have difficulty closing out games, maybe you shouldn't go to a high-end event until you're better at that? Or do you think that's a solution, is to make sure that you're fluent enough with the deck?
Well, I think some of it is, do you know if you can close out the game fast enough? Because I've even read in articles like, you know, insert deck here, you probably shouldn't bring this to a higher level competitive event because of the time issue. I have gotten one slow play comment from a judge before, and it was when Aetherlene was still legal, and I was in a mirror match with two Aetherlenes, and we're trying to, like, out Aetherlene each other. And he was like, I just need you to play a little faster. I'm like, I'm sorry. But, you know, where the last two people playing, you got, like, 10 people watching you. The judge is sitting right there. And I'm like, I could just pack it in right now. Like, I can't handle all these people, like, staring at me. So I think if you feel competent with the deck and you know that, you know, you can finish in a timely fashion, then I don't think it's a bad thing. But I definitely wouldn't suggest someone bringing a really grindy deck to a big tournament if they haven't had enough reps in with it yet, because then you'll probably just end up going to time or frustrating your opponent, or you could get a slow play warning. Definitely, if you're going to play something like that, you should get more practice with it. I definitely think so. But I feel bad for people, though, if they've been in that situation with a lot of inconsistency where, you know, someone got a warning or they did, but the other person didn't. It's like, you kind of want to, I would feel like I would have to stop the judge and be like, I have a question. Why are you giving me, like, a slow play warning but not them? Like, they took more time than I did. Like, do you have another reason why you would give me the warning over them, even though they took more time? Because I was noticing that in Paolo's article, it's like, was there another reason behind it that the judge just didn't state? Like, did they have other things going on in their brain meets that they were like, I'll give this person this whole play warning, but not this other person? So I just didn't know if there's any other factors that come into play with that.
Yeah. I remember, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I remember when Flock's deck took off, and, you know, naturally all of the content sites were like, you too can play this deck. And I'm like, no, 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 because everybody who's going to pick up this deck who doesn't have experience with that style of control deck, and then we have to suffer through that while you Forrest Gump your way through the deck. And and I could tell, and there were certainly people for, like, you know, a smooth 2 weeks after that where I would be at an event of some kind, and I would see, like, the first couple plays, and I'm like, oh, here we go. And you could tell the people who were fluent in the deck, and you could tell the people that were like, I read this on Star City and it looks like fun. And it's like, no, you need to be able to say, this deck is, I mean, this is a fun deck, but is this for me? You know, can I get what I need in 50 minutes or less? And if you can't, you may need to practice it at home, practice it online, you know, until you get to that point. Like, I get really bothered when people kind of put me through that.
Yeah, and I, as a judge, I feel horrible. We had a, it was, like, one of our last, I think, real PTQs, so it was a large event. Or maybe it was just a pre-TQ, I can't remember. But there was a guy, and he was playing mono-green with, like, Genesis Hydra and, you know, Nykthos and, like, mana and counters and all these different things. And I was sitting right next to him, and he was one of the last matches, not the last one, but there was a big group around us. And he's been thinking on this attack for, like, probably a good minute or 2 minutes, but the board is very complex. Like, I took it into account, and I was like, okay, I'll let him count and do, you know, what he needs to do. And he's counting, and then he loses track, and he starts counting again. I was like, okay, okay. And so then I was finally like, I need you to make a play, and he keeps counting. And then, you know, because I thought I had, like, reset him, you know, so I gave him a little bit of extra time for that. And then, you know, he didn't make a play, and I was like, I'm going to have to give you a slow play warning. And he looks at me, and he was like, what? Why? And I was like, didn't you hear me tell you to make a play? And he was like, no. And I was like, oh, God. And he was, like, so focused that even with me sitting right next to him being like, you need to make a play, he, like, didn't even hear it at all. And I was like, oh, man. But I think, you know, I probably should have stepped in earlier, but with giving the slow play to one person over another, you know, the warnings don't, they're not, like, the most detrimental thing. I mean, they give each player an extra turn if the time goes, or if the match goes to time, rather than, you know, a normal warning, which usually you fix the game or whatever, but I think sometimes judges just realize the game is going slowly, and then the next time that somebody starts to play even, like, a little slow, they're like, oh, I should give a slow play warning here, which isn't correct, but I think that's kind of what happens. Like, you're watching a match, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, yeah, they're both kind of playing slow, and then you sit up, and you stop counting your cards or looking at the board state or whatever you're doing, and then you start counting, and then the person's taking, you know, a little bit too long, whoever's turn it is, and then I think sometimes people just get caught in the crossfire.
Yeah. Crossfire.
What you?
Sorry.
Right, I thought of that too.
I had to do it.
What you really need, Katie, is you guys need bullhorns, because you said that the guy didn't catch, the guy didn't even hear you. You need like the doo doo, and then be like, "Sir, I need you to make a play."
Well, and I think sometimes I think I am too quiet, and like that's my own fault. But I felt like I was talking loud, like. I felt like I was like, I need you to make a play, like, you know, like to a person with a hearing aid, but apparently it didn't work. It did not work.
Katie, the bullhorn Neil.
Yes, I do kind of need like a personal microphone. I'm not very loud at pre-TQs and stuff. I try, but then I feel like I'm just like yelling at them, and then that's no good. And then they're like, why is that girl yelling? So then I'm quieter, and then nobody can hear, and it's just... That's one of the biggest things I have to work on, like, tournament to tournament when I'm judging, is my loudness of voice.
Oh, man, I wish I had that problem. My voice carries no matter what I do. Like, when I think I'm being quiet, oh, no. Like, I can be at a restaurant. I think Chris and I have been through this. We're like, you know, we'll be spilling some tea, and I'll be like, you know, I can't believe she's wearing those leopard print pants, and I think that I'm whispering, and then yet the and then the woman with the leopard print pants hears me, and I'm like, shit. And I don't have a whisper setting. Everything I say just comes out loud and carries. So I have the opposite problem. So if you wanna trade, Katie, we can do this.
Or maybe we could just meld and we'll both be normal.
Oh man, that would be frightening. You and I in the same body, the damage we would do.
It would be extensive.
It would be. Uh-huh. Gender-neutral pronouns have been a really hot topic lately. I believe this all started on Reddit. There's a subreddit called Spikes, which I happen to frequent because I think there's some good conversation there. The mods of that subreddit posted a request called Gender Inclusiveness and Foresight on Spikes, asking members to consider using gender-neutral or inclusive pronouns to make the subreddit more inclusive. And then the theory behind this is that with the audience, you know, becoming more diverse, you know, you don't necessarily know that the person you're playing on Magic Online is in fact male. You know, it could be a woman on the other end. It could be somebody who prefers no pronouns. You know, they're gender neutral. And so, you know, taking that into account when you describe your matches or hypothetical situations really goes a long way. Chris, what do you think about this? Like, do you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good idea to call people what they prefer to be referred to as, but I make that mistake all the time. Like, when I'm with a donor, and I'll be like, oh, you should probably talk to your doctor and see what he has to say. Like, I'm really bad at just saying he, you know, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, women are doctors too, hello. But I'm not thinking about it while I'm saying it, and I think that a lot of it for people is just they're so used to saying one thing that they don't even think about it. But if someone, you know, told me, you know, no... You know, I'm a girl, and they were my opponent on Magic. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, or something. Like, it was wrong for me to assume, or other things like that. But I think anybody can make that mistake. When I was reading through the thread, though, I was just like, and maybe this is just me. I'm like, really? This is a thing? Like, this is a big deal? Like, I guess I'm not as, I don't know, concerned about that as some other people. And maybe it's because I'm just so used to correcting people anyway that... I've just gotten used to being like, no, you know, that's not how this is, or please don't say that, or something. So, like, to me, like I said, I'll do whatever, you know, whoever wants me to do, but it just wasn't really too much of a big deal to me as a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a little confused when I saw a lot of people fighting back with the moderators and arguing with them over this issue. I agree with Chris that these sorts of things are ingrained in us. Like, we've been using these terms from the time we were children, and it's really hard to readjust and to say different things. Like, I completely understand that. But it takes all of 30 seconds to look over your post before you post it and be conscious and just make a slight change if it means that it will make other people feel more comfortable. I don't think it takes that much effort. And I'm really glad when I do see people in the community using, you know, gender-neutral pronouns or, you know, not necessarily always male pronouns. I know in the streaming community, this is kind of a big deal. I know James Turner from the sketch comedy group Loading Ready Run has said on their stream that he makes a point of saying they when referring to his opponent, because he knows that, you know, so many people say he and they assume that their opponent is male, and that's not always necessarily true. So I think it's a small thing. It can be a difficult thing because we're not used to it, but I think it's definitely worth the effort.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about people who, you know, in response to this, they bring up the subject of grammar, and they bring up the subject of how, you know, that the male pronoun is sort of the grammatically right thing to use, and that when you ask people to do this, it's almost like some sort of affront to the English language. Like, do you buy that?
I'm not going to lie. I was an English major. I am a writer. Using they is slightly uncomfortable for me. Mm-hmm. It's something I make an effort to do. I know we've answered listener questions for people who are either agender or non-binary, and I've been conscious to use they, and I've been conscious to use they around, you know, everyone I know who's non-binary, but it's definitely difficult for me. It's something that I have to make myself do, and, you know, I notice myself talking a little bit slower and being a little more conscious, and I'm hoping that I can eventually, like, train myself out of this, because it's becoming more and more common to refer to people with the pronoun they, but it's definitely a challenge for me.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I'll be having a conversation with someone at, like, the game store, and I catch myself doing it, and I'm always like, well, that's what he would have done. And then I'm like, or she. But even that is, like, not, you know, the most inclusive. And so it's, I think it is really ingrained in us. And while I respect it, and I'm willing to try and change it, I guess I'm not a huge, like, stickler on it. I don't mind if people, you know, say he as a all-inclusive term. Although I was reading some of the comments on the thread, and they were like, people don't mind because it's so ingrained, and then it's just kind of like this spiral where, you know, I don't know if you're ever winning on Reddit, but, you know, and I was thinking about it, and I was like, yeah, I should try that more. And I think that just the fact that it's brought up and, you know, people are talking about it is good. But I guess I'm just not a huge, you know, huge stickler for it. But I don't mind trying to improve by any means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely appreciate when people do that. I know Huey got a lot of praise over the weekend because he was using the female pronoun in hypothetical situations, you know, and Reed Duke will even do that in articles too, where he will say, you know, your opponent could have this and then she does this. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that. And, you know, people like to bring up, you know, bigger fish to fry. You know, they will see a situation like this and they will say, you know, is this a real concern? Like, don't we have anything better to worry about? And my response to that is, I kind of feel like it's a foundation, like you're building a house, and it's really little things. Like, you know, we've talked about dirty bathrooms before, and you start building your house with this foundation made up of dirty bathrooms, made up of people using the default male pronoun. And I feel like all of that sort of contributes to the bigger problem. problems. You know, two of the women being treated poorly at events are what some would call a bigger issue. I feel like when enough of these smaller issues happen, we get to that point. And so it is important to sort of pick away that foundation, you know, those microaggressions that lead to the bigger issues. And so so I'm all for this, you know, especially as somebody who has had to deal with both pronouns in my day. You know, I certainly appreciate people wanting to make it more inclusive. And, you know, like you said, I mean, even if it's something that you personally don't have a problem with, once somebody says they do have a problem with it, you know, you have two choices. You can choose to either disregard what they're feeling, or you can be like, you know what, this is clearly bothering somebody. This is clearly, you know, keeping somebody from enjoying this content. What's the harm in just changing? What's the harm in meeting them halfway? Is that really the hill you want to die on? You know, do you really want to say to somebody, no? Like, why do you want that to be your last stand? Like, of all the things you could fall down and die for, is this the one you really want to fight over? You know, and like I said, you know, people like to say, well, don't you have anything better to fight about? Do you have anything better to defend? Would be my response. Like, you know, the people that are fighting really passionately to not have to do this, why? You know, like, it's just an extra 5 seconds when you're forming a sentence. Is that really a lot? Like, I don't really understand, you know, where the backlash is coming from. I think it's as simple as somebody saying, this would make me feel better, and you going, cool. Like, to me, that's the end of discussion.
Yeah, and there was a few people that were like, why are we worrying about this when we could be worrying about something more important or whatever? And I was like, why not just worry about it all? Like, we're all worried about stuff. Like, you can fit another little thing into your worry bubble in your brain. Like, it's, I don't feel like it's that, I don't know. I felt like some people were trying to dismiss it for more important things, with air quotes. But I feel like, you know, you can just lump it all in and try and get it all in one go.
Yeah, I mean, people feel like it's an either-or proposition where it's like, you know, will you either have to be concerned about the gender pronouns, or you have to be concerned about women being, you know, harassed at events. It's like, well, you can do both. Like, you can politely hope that people use different pronouns, and you can also hope to make events safer. Like, you don't have to choose. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of people who try to get involved in discussions like this, you know, they make it seem like either-or. Or even when it comes to women, people think, well, if I support women, that means I'm shitting on men. And it's like, no, you can absolutely love men and still push for more rights for women and push for better places for women. You don't have to choose. Mm-hmm. You really can have it all.
Yeah. You can buy all those groceries.
You can get all the bacon on your cheeseburger, as I like to say. Our listener question this week, send your questions to thegirlfriendbracket@gmail.com. And this question is from Luna. Luna says, hey guys, big fan of the show, and I'm writing because I have a bit of a question. The guy who runs F&M at my local game store is very brusque and a terse guy. Unless you're a fellow employee or a regular, he seems to be very short with you. He's also the judge, so whenever I call him over for a ruling, he always makes me feel like there's hundreds of other things he'd rather be doing than answering my question. Do I just need to toughen up, or is this something I can bring up, and if so, how? Thanks.
That's kind of a bad situation. That's kind of a hard subject to broach, I think, with the owner of the store who also happens to be the judge. Thankfully, where I play at, I don't really have that kind of issue. But if I did, I think I would just be like, maybe later be like, you know, hey, you know, I just don't know if there's like a thing here, but, you know, I'm just asking you for rules clarifications, or, you know, calling a judge call like other players that attend, you know, F&M at the store. Is there something that I've done that you didn't like or something? Like, I just want to be part of the community here, and I just want to make sure that there's not a problem, because maybe he doesn't even realize that he's kind of being a jerk. Or he could just be a person that, you know, he's bothered by the littlest thing, and maybe he just likes his regulars, and maybe that's just him. But I don't think it hurts to ask, but definitely make sure you're comfortable asking in that situation, because you never know how people might be. They might be the type to explode off and be like, what are you talking about? The problem clearly isn't me, it's you. So I would tread kind of lightly with it. It's unfortunate that, you know, they are the person that owns the store, that they want people to come in and play, but then they have an attitude that they sort of don't. So I think they need to kind of reevaluate personally how they really feel about running F&M at their store. Do they really want, you know, to be the judge? Maybe they need someone else to take over the responsibility. Maybe it's a lot for them to deal with. So it seems like there's probably a lot of other things maybe going on behind the scenes. At least that's what I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think one point of clarification that I think I would like in order to better answer this question is, and I'm not really sure if I'm reading the email, is whether the owner is brusque with her or if that's just how he is with everyone. Mm-hmm. I think if he is just like a little bit curmudgeonly, that's kind of unfortunate, but you know, some people, you know, once they get to be adults, that's just how they are. They don't always change. If he is very short with her specifically and not with other people, I think that's more of a concern, because, you know, as a store owner and as a tournament organizer, you want to promote an environment that's welcoming to everyone in your store. And I think, you know, that's something that you could potentially bring up with the owner himself. You know, as Chris said, tread lightly, but if it escalates from there, it might be something worth bringing up with Wizards.
Yeah, and I also wasn't sure from the email if the owner was the person running the FNM, or if they, like, have, you know, a person who runs their FNM, and then there's also an owner of the store, like, if this person's the manager or something. But I think, obviously, if they are not the owner, you could talk to the owner. But we have somebody vaguely like this at our store. And what they've done is they just have a different employee that runs FNMs. The person that acts like this is just not a huge fan of Magic players in general. But we just have a different person that started running our FNMs, and everything has kind of gone smoothly from there. But another thing you might be able to do is talk to a different employee, and maybe, you know, if they're all buddy-buddy, then maybe the employee could bring up, hey, I think some of the players may be feeling like you're not the nicest, or that you're a little bit too brusque, and maybe you could be, you know, just a little more friendly, and then we'd have a more, you know, welcoming environment. If there's anybody like that at the store, I think that could be a good alternative, is to talk to a different employee and bring it up.
Yeah, I agree with you all. I definitely think probing is the best way to go. You know, asking around to the people that you play with, see if they've had similar experiences, see if they maybe know him. I admit that I'm sometimes not the easiest to get along with, and that, you know, there are people who, you know, may have had an experience with me, and yet they ask somebody and they will say, Erin just came off of a difficult game, or, you know, she doesn't really know you. And sometimes giving people those disclaimers can be like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, maybe they can understand what that person was going through, or talk to the employees. Like I think Katie said, you know, try to see where that person's coming from. If, you know, you are talking to people in your store and they have had similar experiences, and you can sort of build a case against that person, I would sort of gather that information and then say to them, you know, hey, you know, I feel like you feel a certain way about me, and I'm not the only one. Is it just me? Like, what's going on here? And kind of see where that interaction goes. You know, let them do the explaining. You know, don't explain for them. Like, don't come up to them and say, you know, you've been shitty. You know, just say, you know, we've noticed that this is happening. What's your take on that? Like, are we seeing this correctly? You know, what's going on there? I think if the person was consistently negative towards you, like if they were riding your ass, I would just pop off, because that's just me. I would be like, I'm giving you money and you need to knock the fuck off. But it doesn't sound like that's kind of the situation. So I think probing and going into it with as much information as you can before you talk to them is the best plan of action. And then keeping it very open-ended, you know, let them kind of explain themselves and then decide how you want to take it from there.
And another good thing that I just wanted to add in is that since they are a judge, you could talk to their regional coordinator. And if you need help looking that up, you can definitely shoot me an email and I'll help you out. But the, you know, judges should not be viewed as mean people. Like, you know, we want the community to be welcoming for everyone. And so maybe he just needs somebody to remind him, like, hey, seems like some players are just not super impressed with your behavior at FNM or whatever. Maybe you could try and improve on that. But that's a very anonymous way to go. You know, so you're not the target of anything if that's a concern, and might just be a good alternative as well.
Yeah. Final thoughts before we wrap up the show.
I'm playing a doubleheader this weekend. I'm very excited.
What formats?
Standard.
Standard. Double standard.
Double standard, yeah.
Oh, wow. Are they both PPTQs?
Yep. I'm hoping that I just win the first one, so then I don't have to play till, like, midnight. But, you know, girls can dream.
Yeah, there's a 5K, a TCG 5K happening this weekend that's standard, but I don't think I'll get my standard deck built in time. Otherwise, I would like to play that. And, I'm just really excited to play some standard lately, which I never thought I would say, so I hope I get to play some. I'm trying to shoot for the TCG Invitational. If I can somehow get my hands on 20 TCG points, which is going to be kind of difficult. But I have been really interested also in the new Commander decks.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
I know I'm very excited about the black-white Daxos enchantment deck. And I know Chris and I, we've had fun playing the Commander decks out of the box, so maybe that's something we could do in Oakland.
Yeah. I was looking at the blue-green one, and I was like, oh man, I get to evoke a Moldrifter, and then Eternal Witness back a Moldrifter and evoke it again? This is amazing!
It's almost like we're playing with Brago all over again.
I know, right?
Katie, would you be interested in that if we all picked up Commander decks?
Yeah, that would be fun. Did everybody get their flights? Are we, like, officially a go?
Yes, we are.
I'm a go, but I'm waiting till the last minute to get my flight. Because my plan is, so I'm trying to pay off my credit card before the end of the year. So the plan is my credit card will be paid off before we go to Oakland. And then I'll put the flight on the credit card. And then tax returns come. And I can immediately put the tax return on the credit card. So that way I'm not having to, you know, completely poop on my freshly paid off credit card.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's kind of my strategy.
Cool.
Yeah. And then I also asked Chris, so there's a GP in Detroit, which is Modern. And I was like, Chris, you want to go to a Modern GP? It's like, we could road trip it.
When is that?
So we'll,
in February.
I thought it was in March.
Is it in March? Oh, wait. Yes. Yeah, yes. March 4th and 5th and 6th, I think. Yeah. Ooh. Oh, yeah. I already had it in my phone, my bad, because I knew I had to work that weekend. So I'm going to see what I can do.
Oh, we should go. That'd be so much fun. I've never been to Detroit.
I don't know if we're missing a lot. I'm not sure. I've heard conflicting things. Yeah. No disrespect to Detroit. Keep it real.
Well, I think it'd be a lot of fun if we could pull it off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if anybody's enjoyed listening to the show, how can they find you all and how can they get a hold of you?
So, I'm Hallie. You can find me on Twitter at HalcanSan. That's HalcanSan. If you want to read the articles that I wrote at GP CTAC, you can look up the coverage. And I wrote an article about a woman named Barbara McCann and an interview with Reed Duke. I enjoyed writing both of them, and if you guys want to read them, that would be great. You can also find my writing here on Gathering Magic. By the time this episode comes out, I believe I'll have another article up, and I'll have another one up next week.
Wow. You're really, really cruising.
It sort of comes in waves. I have bouts of seasonal affective disorder, which definitely affects the amount of writing that I can produce during certain amounts of time, and during the fall I tend to be more prolific than I am during the summer and winter.
It's a tough act to follow, Katie.
I know, like some weeks I'm just like, well, we should just end the show here. And I'm Katie. You can find me on Twitter at meanmugger, that's MEANMUGGER, or you can find me by email, katie.neil14@gmail.com.
And I'm Chris. My Twitter name is @Chris, at @TEHKRIZ. My Gmail is YOTEHKRIZ, yotechris@gmail.com. And my Snapchat is cryptic, command with Ks, and you guys have been sending me some awesome pics, so keep it up.
And I'll have you know, I have a brand new cell phone with a camera that works, so I can take advantage of this too, you know.
Yeah, do it.
Katie's not the only one that can send you Snapchats. We'll have to have like a competition.
Who can send Chris the most Snapchats?
Yay.
And then we won't end the show until Chris picks a winner.
I've already submitted my entry.
Yep, just now.
Oh, it's like that now. It's like that. Okay. And I'm Erin. You can find me on Twitter at Original Estrus. That is ORIGINALOESTRUS. You can email me at estrus@elitistjerks.com. The show is on Twitter at the GF Bracket, and you can email us at thegirlfriendbracket@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.